How has the pandemic reshaped your life? It would be very unusual if you haven't had some major upheaval over the last couple of years. But what's going to remain? What's going to be a long-term trend? What's going to be a legacy of these lockdowns? And what fads are going to be gone, soon forgotten? Now, I'm sure many of us would like to actually forget the last couple of years, but that'll be pretty hard to forget, won't it? In fact, it's likely that COVID will leave scars on some of us, how we do things, what we feel comfortable with, how we want to live. But COVID's also brought a couple of positive innovations. It's brought forward a number of trends, which were probably going to happen anyway, and things that are going to improve our lives. So in today's show, I want to discuss these because whether you're a property investor, a business owner, a professional, understanding these social trends post-COVID will be critical for your success. And who better to discuss them with than our regular guest, leading demographer, Simon Kirstenmacher. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
As we move into a new world of what some may call COVID normal, what will we look back on as a short-term fad and what's going to last forever? Which trends will last? Will it be online shopping, working from home, where we want to live, how we want to live? That's what I'm going to discuss today with leading demographer Simon Kirstenmacher, director of the Demographics Group, because if we want to understand how the pandemic is going to reshape our wish lists, not just for housing and property, but many things in life, it's going to make things much easier for us, much better for us as investors, as business people and entrepreneurs. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks for having me back, Michael.
Yes, life's getting back to normal again and we found our freedom again. And I know there's a number of things I had to do over the last couple of years that I'm really pleased I'm going to be able to leave behind me. But there's also a number of things I'm not going to give back. So let's look at a number of the social trends that you've been writing about in your regular columns, that you've been doing your research on, so we can see how these are going to shape demand and the way we're going to live moving forward. The big one, of course, Simon, that there's been a lot of talk about is the work from home trend. What do you see happening there?
Well, at least half of the locked down cities tended to work at home during the pandemic. And for a long time, particularly in Melbourne, people worked from home for about a year and a half now. So that means
We both know it, son?
Don't we know it? Absolutely. And that's definitely long enough for habits to form. Many, many people adjusted their homes, maybe completely adjusted their locality. They might have actually moved to a larger home to have a Zoom room. So there's very little appetite in some corners of the workforce to go back to full-time work in an office. And that will lead to a couple of conflicts when workers will want to work from home more and bosses will want the people to be in the office more. So there is a future conflict ahead that's already emerging. And we will need to see how this plays out. So before the pandemic, 5% of the population worked from home on any given day. And that includes farmers who have no other choice than to work from home. And during the lockdown, it was around 50%. So the new normal will probably be around the 12, 15% or something thereabouts. So we'll have more people in suburbia during the day instead of in the city center. That has implications for commercial real estate. It means that you don't buy your lunch or your coffees in an inner city cafe, but you might either buy it at a suburban cafe or you might not purchase it at all in a cafe. You might cook yourself. You might have more appetites for ready-made meals, or you might just make a piece of toast or something as simple as that.
Well, when you look at the numbers though, Simon, you say 10, 12% of the workforce, that could mean an extra 1 million workers are not going to be doing their daily commute and working from home for some days of the week.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right there. When we just say an increase of 10%, you know, at 10% more of the people working from home, it doesn't sound so much. But we're literally talking about seven-digit figures of people that work from home rather than an office on any given day. You know, if I'm invested in commercial real estate, I ask a couple of questions immediately. I'm asking, well, so be it. If people work from home occasionally, they will still be in the office at some stage. So there is still appetite for commercial real estate. Maybe the really big players reduce their footprint a tiny bit, but not massively. And if we take this to the really next level and we say, well, who cares what the bosses want? Who cares what the workers want? Let's think about what would be ideal for any given job. Just let's make put the efficiency lens on, which is very close to my German heart, is any kind of work task or job that you have divides into two kinds of tasks. The first task segment are quiet work tasks where you need to concentrate, you need to sit in front of a computer and you need to write an email, you need to program, you need to write a PowerPoint document or something like this. These kind of tasks are best done at home, where you hopefully have fewer distractions than in a big rowdy office. But for many, many tasks, you are better off just sitting at a desk in a meeting room with your colleagues to brainstorm, to collaborate on projects. And ideally, you can split your work week roughly into two, where you do your collaborative tasks in the city center, in an office with your colleagues, and you do your quiet thinking tasks at home. I don't want to see people sitting in an open plan office with noise canceling headphones, writing an email. Nobody wins there. There's no benefit. So if we split this work into roughly doing the quiet work at home, roughly doing the collaborative work in the CBD, it means we need to rethink our CBDs. You need to have offices with more collaborative spaces, more meeting rooms, more kitchens to mingle. People, when they are in the CBD, they will be out and about. They will be going to cafes, meeting with colleagues and clients. And so the CBD will be a much more lively location. So I would actually really enjoy a CBD like this because the jobs would win. We are not missing out on the important collaborative social element of work, which some people are afraid we are missing out in the working from home movement.
Sure. So there is still a future for the CBDs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the CBD will look different. You can't have a massive event like COVID occurring. You can't force behavior change on a population for a year and a half and then think it does not have lasting impacts.
And in the big capital cities of Melbourne and Sydney, when the immigration borders open up again and we get, firstly, tourists, I guess, but more importantly, the skilled migrants, many of them are going to initially gravitate to around the CBD.
Oh, absolutely. And so the CBD will not die. It will not go away. It will not turn back into wilderness or anything. It's as Sydney and Melbourne in particular grow at probably soon 100,000 plus people per year again, the CBD will fill up eventually. You know, I can easily say this because I don't own an office tower in the CBD. My money isn't personally invested in there. Those people who have really their money invested in the CBD, they of course try to push people to come back at high rates. But overall, their assets aren't at risk. Overall, throughout the next couple of years, the inner city will completely recover, but it won't be for another 2 to 3 years for sure.
And in the meantime, we've recognized the importance of neighborhood, and that'll continue on. So those lessons won't be forgotten either, especially that concept of the 20-minute neighborhood, the ability to work, to live, to play within 20 minutes of where you want to be, what you want to do. That's become very important, especially if you're going to be working from home. You may still want to pop out, but just go to the local main street rather than, or to the local hairdresser as opposed, or the local doctor or physiotherapist rather than the one in the CBD.
Oh, Absolutely. So the importance of the neighborhoods. I think it's quite nice to see how during lockdowns, people continued to support their local cafes that could only do takeaway, and people purposefully went out of their way to purchase at least a couple of cups of coffee per week from their favorite shop because they wanted this business to continue to be in their neighborhood. So that's it shows the importance of community. During COVID, many people talked way more with their neighbors than they did previously. So it created a more intense sense of community. But these kind of shifts about COVID that we're talking about here, they differ from city to city. They differ on the based on the level of lockdowns, on the harshness of the lockdowns. So whereas before COVID, we could quite easily make statements about the future of all capital cities, we now need to be more selective. We do know, for example, that all those changes will be most intense in Melbourne because Melburnians were locked down for longer. So behavior shifts took deeper roots in Melbourne compared to a free city of Brisbane or Perth.
Very much so. Clearly, they say they felt sorry for us when we were locked down, Simon, didn't they? They really didn't know what we were going through. But the trends do seem to have translated across the borders a bit. And one of the trends seems to be, if we're going to be working from home more, what are we going to do with our homes? How are we going to live? What do we need? We're spending more money on home improvements, aren't we? I think Bunnings did really well over the last couple of years.
Bunnings would have benefited. So you have this big movement anyways that's occurring from the big millennial generation. It just happened through demographic dumb luck to start families at the time of the pandemic, at the time of the pandemic recovery as well. So you have the millennials leaving the inner cities and they're purchasing family-sized homes. The home probably needs to be even larger because they need a Zoom room. Many millennials are knowledge workers that can work from home, must work from home, want to work from home. So then they purchase those homes. They millennials aren't loaded. So and they purchase in an expensive market. So therefore, they purchase homes that are a bit substandard, homes that need quite a bit of improvement throughout the coming decade. So if I was a tradie, if I was the CEO of Bunnings, I would look at the next decade and I'd be very excited about the business opportunities. There are lots of niche opportunities that I would see. You know, I'm pointing out as well, there's the trend towards an aging population, a trend towards more single female households, widows and also women, young women who stay single for longer. There's apparently a demand for female-only trade businesses that you might feel uncomfortable to have a male tradie coming to your home. And if there was a pink plumber business or whatever you might want to call it, I'm sure there's this big niche for this to actually target very specific niches for the entrepreneurial-minded tradie. There's also the idea of the part of the millennial cohort that has money and that is now in the need of upgrading. Sell to them premium luxury European branded, you know, call it luxury European home upgrades or something like this. There is a top end of the market that is very lucrative to tap into. These are people who need to have their homes redone. These are people who need maybe an office squeezed into the garden, something like this. There's a huge market that is only going to grow over the next 10 years.
So let's make it clear, the millennials in general, they're the baby boomers' children. They were born between 1984 and 2002, aged 19 to 37. And over the next 5 years, they're going to push into their late 30s. They're going to push into their 40s. They've left their family formation a bit later than the generations before them. But they're upgraders now. They've upgraded to homes rather than apartments. And that's going to create a huge surge in demand for certain sorts of properties in the family-friendly residential suburbs.
Absolutely. And that's the why we've seen rising house prices as well. So at the start of the pandemic, some people promised the millennials a discount of 20, 30% on their housing, which didn't occur. The opposite was the case. And from a demographic perspective, there is, of course, macroeconomic drivers as well, of course. But from a demographic perspective, that isn't a surprise because all of a sudden you have the biggest generation in Australia leaving small dwellings in the inner city in search for large dwellings, wherever they are available and affordable. And you don't have the movement of the baby boomers downsizing at the same time, which would free up lots of family-sized homes for the millennial buyers. That isn't happening at scale yet. The home, the downsizer baby boomer movement will not happen at scale until the 2030s. Because baby boomers don't downsize for financial reasons where they think it might be financially an astute move to sell the house now and to downgrade to a smaller dwelling in Queensland. That's not happening. People tend to downsize once the family home becomes a nuisance to manage or becomes a physical hazard. So,
and we're not moving into retirement villages either, Simon.
Absolutely not. I think that movement is completely gone for those people who can afford it. The idea of the independently minded baby boomer generation is to stay in the family home as an independent person for as long as you can. So that drives the demand for in-home care services, community nurses that come, little household helpers, all these kind of jobs will rise massively. Gardening services, if this becomes too hard for the baby boomers, there's plenty of business opportunities out there.
So to make it clear, the baby boomers, my generation, were born between 1946 and 64. They're aged between 62 and 75. And in previous years, maybe they were already heading into retirement, but a lot of these people weren't manual laborers, were they, Simon? So they're working longer. They're transitioning into retirement as opposed to suddenly getting that gold watch and sitting on the porch watching time go by. But they're reinventing their retirement. They're doing different things nowadays, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. So that's the big movement. You have half of the baby boomer generation of retirement age already. But as you mentioned, they're not necessarily all retired, specifically because knowledge work allows you to work longer. Physical tasks, the older you get, the harder they get. But lots of the knowledge work, you just benefit now. You accrued a great network. You have so much knowledge. It's just getting fun as you hit your 60s. And so those people stick around for a bit longer. They slowly transition, they slide into retirement. They take down the hours, only work 3 days per week, still stay connected with the business, do the occasional consulting, but also take big chunks of time off to go to Europe and travel the world. And of course, this was part of their life plan, was to really enjoy the retirement, because it's a wealthy generation that created wealth through the housing market, through a boom economy during most of their working life. But now during COVID, that didn't work. Baby boomers wanted to go out and about, wanted to visit the grandparents, wanted to visit Europe, but it didn't work simply because the borders were closed. And so they feel the sense of urgency now. So the baby boomers, as soon as the borders are open, they will head out and about and visit their kids studying in London or whatever is going on there. They'll travel the world. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
So, Simon, the baby boomers, they stashed their cash, they've put money aside, they haven't been able to travel, and they're planning, I guess, now to spend their kids' inheritance and methodically tick off the activities from their ever-expanded bucket list. They're healthy, they're a wealthy generation, much more so than their parents were in their 60s and 70s.
That, of course, has implications for the housing market as well. So kids, of course, want their parents to live a long and healthy life, and they want their parents to be out and about and happy. What that means is that baby boomers probably, it's anybody's guess, will eat through their super savings, for example, which is, by the way, what superannuation is meant to do. Superannuation is meant to be used up by the day you die. Ideally, you end up with $0 on your account balance on the day you die. But that's not what happened so far with the previous retirees, is that they didn't spend their super. So from an economic perspective, you want as much of the retirement savings used up by the older populations. And so far, a lot of wealth was then transferred to the next generation as people died. And we're now trying to understand how much of this will go on in the millennial, in the baby boomer generation, how much the millennials will then inherit. But the millennials, of course, will only inherit money at scale when their parents die or when the mother dies. The mother won't die until her mid-80s, which means that the millennials inherit money in their late 50s. So what stage of the housing life cycle are you in then? You might become a downsizer, you might spend the money there, but probably not. Probably the millennials that inherit money are already settled with their housing, and then this money will just be used to top up their super savings, or there'll be financial vehicles to use this money. But so there is this big intergenerational wealth transfer issue that is just looming on the horizon. And essentially, from an economic perspective, we need to say we hope that the baby boomers just spend an awful lot of money, because that helps the millennials and the economy as a whole right now, rather than inheriting it 20 years later, when it's a bit of an awkward stage of the life cycle to get into money into your late 50s.
Oh, I agree with you. And I think in general, baby boomers are now comfortable spending their money, the money they've saved. They feel they've worked hard and they now deserve it. Now, I love talking about the various generations, because it actually gives us the idea of what drives our markets, what's going to be ahead, when people are going to spend. And we know that there's this peak spending time when your kids leave, you've got lots of money. So I really enjoy your weekly columns in the New Daily, where every Sunday you write about the generations, and you're doing some great videos on YouTube, as we're running those on Property Update as well. So I'd encourage anyone who wants to understand more about how we do things differently at different stages of our life and how that's going to affect property, business, the economy, to keep a track of Simon's columns in the New Daily. And he's subscribed to his YouTube channel. And of course, watch out on Property Update for that as well. Now, I know you and your team, Bernard Salt and others, have come up with a couple of other acronyms. What's the fun of being a demographer if you haven't got some smart acronyms? So we've spoken about baby boomers, we've spoken about millennials, but what other clever names have you come up with for what's been going on during COVID?
Well, I think one of the big terms are the VESPAs, the virus escapees seeking provincial Australia. These are the millennials, essentially, that are leaving the inner city in search for big housing, but also in search of, you know, less risk of being locked down. So they move from hipster to parts of the big smoke to regional provincial Australia. And they will then take their values, their demands, their shopping habits into regional Australia. This means regional Australia is now going to be hipsterized by the millennial generation over the next couple of years.
But not all of regional Australia, from what I understand, it's really areas it's in that Goldilocks zone where it's not too far, but it's not too close either. So you actually can commute when you need to.
Exactly. The goal here is ideally to settle in a provincial, in a regional hub that is really well connected to the capital city. And of course, all the infrastructure upgrades that the millennial generation would demand are connecting the regional hubs with the capital city. So there will be an infrastructure surge, which will then drive growth along these new train lines, new roadways, ideally as well.
So, continuing on with the VESPA analogy, they're going to be scootering out of the capital cities and moving into the regional areas. Any other clever new acronyms?
Well, there are, as an option of the alteration of the fly-in, fly-out, those FIFO workers, we now call them the fly-in, zoom-out, FISO workers, or even the combination, the, you know, which might be called the Fonzies, the fly out, zoom in workers. Yep. You know, so like Guns N' Roses.
Yes.
So that's a new trend of this hybrid model, where you actually want to work remotely for most of the time, but you do understand that occasionally it is just required for you to be physically present at a couple of events, or maybe even at regular intervals in the big city center. And I guess we need to see how this plays out over time, how far we can go out, how far the Vespas can travel, and how much you need to be physically present. That will determine the geographical setup of population across the continent.
Now, we shouldn't belittle those who've had health issues. We don't want to play down the financial issues that many small businesses have had and employees have had. But overall, the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows that total Australian wealth, household wealth, and that's net wealth because we know people have taken on debt, but net wealth has risen considerably, 5.8% over the June quarter alone to be the highest it's ever been, despite all the challenges. We're probably 19.7% wealthier than we were a year ago. That's the strongest, the fastest annual growth in wealth for 11 years, Simon. Of course, this has got to do with the strong growth in house prices, the strong growth in shares and people's superannuation funds. In fact, Australian households have never been wealthier. It's interesting also, a recent report by Credit Suisse estimated there's 1.8 million Aussies that are considered millionaires today, based on their estimates. But between now and 2025, that's going to grow to 3.1 million. So another 1.2 million Aussies are going to become millionaires, I guess, based on their homes. The challenge that I also see, though, unfortunately, is we're losing the middle class. We've spoken about that in previous podcasts, and that could lead to some of the social problems that we see overseas, and that's not good.
Now, that's not good. And so the idea here, quite often we talk about the asset-owning class now, is that if so much of the wealth, the net wealth that you're talking about, is linked to the fact that you own a house, that accrued wealth. And for many Australians, over the last years, they earned more money sitting in their house than going to work. There are plenty of suburbs where a median house that doesn't look like much, to be quite honest, increased by $100,000 per year. And the workers might not have earned $100,000. So that's, of course, a nice thing for everyone who owns a home, but it's nothing that you should get used to. That, of course, needs to stop eventually, this rate of growth, because wages growth, we know this, we heard this a million times, didn't keep pace with the house price growth. So there are certain issues, and it appears to be dividing further, since there are fewer people who own a home. Mind you, that the statistics would actually not tell the story at the moment. At the moment, we have more homeowners than we had before the pandemic. But that's simply because we had all those people that are renting, leaving the countries, international students, skilled migrants that are only on temporary visas left the country. So all of a sudden, you had hundreds of thousands of renters leave the country. Then it makes it look like we have more people in home ownership, even though that's actually not the case.
Well, of course, there were the various grants that encouraged first homeowners to get into the market, and they've worked really well. In general, they weren't really aimed at first homeowners. They were aimed at the building industry to help the economy keep moving.
Exactly. And so if I'm looking at to combine all those trends together, if I'm saying, well, there is a big movement of the big millennial generation to regional Australia, what is needed in regional Australia to make sure that regional Australia isn't suffering is to make sure that all of those regional hubs make enough land available for development. And they need to make sure that this land doesn't eat into like really attractive farmland, for example. So there's a lot of town planning that needs to be done on the regional level, on the suburban and urban fringe level as well. And we then finally need to learn our lesson that Australia hasn't learned over the last two decades, that we need to build infrastructure at the scale that is at least the same as population growth. In Australia, population growth has for too long outpaced infrastructure growth. And that then leads to people hating migration. They hate growth. There's no such thing as a city that is too big. There's no such thing as a city, a town that has too many residents. The size is not a relevant measure of quality. If you add more people, you need to make sure that you grow schools, that you grow amenities, that you grow infrastructure at scale. We haven't done this. And we are just constantly playing catch up with infrastructure in Australia. We'll be saying, okay, we now need to build the infrastructure to connect a Point Cook, to connect a Melton better. But then it becomes super expensive to build infrastructure into an existing area. We have not gone down this path of build it and they will come, where we build rails into regional Australia and then along the way of those high-speed new railways, growth is occurring in a sustainable manner. And we should finally wake up to these realities and really double down on infrastructure investment.
I think one of the challenges is, of course, that Parliament has to spend that money. And when you've got a 3-year tenure in Parliament before the next election, you want to actually see things that are going to give returns straight away. So it's hard for politicians to vote that in. Of course, what you're saying is 100% right. That worked really well in Queensland, where a number of decades ago, they built all those tunnels, they built all those freeways, and it allowed Brisbane to grow very efficiently.
Yeah, I always quote, since we're talking about the Brisbane Olympics quite often, and they will need to build quite a bit of infrastructure as well, I'm pointing to my hometown of Munich in Germany that got the Olympics in the 70s. And so that means during the 60s, when Munich was still bombed out after the Second World War, they got a bit of money to, you know, upgrade the train network. And for some reason, somebody was smart enough to say, we don't stop the train network within the existing boundaries of Munich. We just really build it out heaps into the north, the south, the east, and the west. And this skeleton, 50 or 60 years really onwards, is still determining growth in Lower Bavaria. And ideally, Queensland will do the same thing. Ideally, Australia, in its infrastructure investment, will follow this kind of lead.
Fantastic. Now, as we were discussing the various trends that have occurred to give an idea of what life's going to be like, there's one other that I think's changed too. It's just brought it forward, and that's been the dependent on technology. I've always loved my smartphone. I'm sort of addicted to it, but I've got to use QR codes where I'm going, wherever I am. Social media has changed. I keep up to date with what's happening on social media. It's accelerated a trend that was occurring already.
Exactly. And it reached new groups. I think that's the important thing. There were many, particularly older Australians, who were not forced to keep up with technology through their work. People that are in employment these days really have to use smartphones, have to use apps. They get used to this device, and then they get hooked to the device, and then they get smart on this device. But lots of the older Australians only during the pandemic learned how to use a QR code, learned how to download the COVID tracker app. It might have been a useless app from the pandemic perspective, but it was really a useful app in terms of creating a learning curve for older Australians to use smart technology. So at least there was some use for it. And that now makes sure that we are a smarter, more tech-savvy generation or society.
Well, look how far we've come. We've gotten through it. And as I'm saying that, I just realized that when you and I had this chat 12 months ago at the end of 2020, we thought we had got through it all and life was becoming normal again. So maybe we should be careful what we're saying. But I think it was interesting to look back, see how we're doing things differently. And it looks clearly like a couple of things will stick. And we're so lucky. We are living in a great country at a great time in history. Even though we'd like to forget some of the last year or two, I guess we're not really going to, are we?
No. Those habits will stick. And it's also important what kind of story we tell to ourselves about the last 2 years. Because Australians are not a people that like to suffer. They're not a people that like to be in the role of the victim where you complain how horrible things are. I think that the narrative will change, and quite rightly, to we've managed to get through the pandemic with very low deaths, much lower than anywhere in Europe or the US, for example. And I think that will be a narrative. We now have extremely high vaccination rates. And I think that's a talking point that we should push to the world, saying we actually managed this through a high cost, but we managed it extremely well. And we are now ready for the post-COVID world sooner than countries in Europe will be, where now we have the fourth wave of COVID coming that is larger than the previous waves, which shouldn't be the case, but it still is. So I think there is a reason to be proud of. And I think that's the Australian narrative. You want to tell a positive narrative about your suffering, if you will, because why the hell would you put yourself down?
Very much so. In other words, pessimists tend not to do anywhere near as well as optimists. So let's be optimistic about the future. Simon, it's always fun chatting with you. I'm going to leave some links in the show note to your YouTube channel, to your articles in Property Update, but also in the New Daily, because you're bringing out a lot of content at the moment. And I find it very insightful, very useful. And I look forward to catching up with you again real soon when we have another chat on the show.
Fantastic. Already looking forward to it.
If In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you. But before that, I'd like to say thank you for all the people leaving reviews on Apple Podcasts or the other media players as well. And I'm going to do something, I'm going to reintroduce something I haven't done for a little while by saying thank you to some of the people who are doing it by reading out your reviews and giving you a gift, one of my books, as a way of saying thank you. Recently, Rachel Angerston left a review saying, 5-star review, thank you, saying valuable information. I've just started listening to the podcast and I've learned so much already about property investing as well as finance. Thanks, Michael. This is very valuable for my journey to real estate investing. Well, Rachel, I'd like to help your journey by gifting you one of my books. Just email me, michael@metropole.com.au, and I'll send you one of my books. By the way, if you'd like to leave a review and I read it out, I'll gift you one of my books as well. Now, we had a bit of a chat with Simon a moment ago about what's going to happen in the future. And it'll be interesting to look back, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time and see how history speaks about the pandemics of 2021 and what our world was like and what the future's going to be. Just like I've been investing long enough now to remember back to the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, and things that seemed like a real problem, a real stress, real challenges, very big worries really aren't as big or as important today. But they were really a challenge when we got through. For example, when I first started investing, the median price in Melbourne in 1973 was $19,800. In Sydney, it was $27,400. I bought my first property, went halves with my parents, and it took a 30-year loan. I only had saved $1,000. That's all I could look for as a deposit. So all the challenges then with the passage of time, compounding leverage, have covered up the mistakes I've made, but also created substantial wealth for me. So my suggestion to you is at this time, when there are a lot of difficult messages talking about affordability issues, inflation going up, interest rates going up, should you buy, shouldn't you buy, you really should also be taking a long-term view. Okay, maybe not a 50-year view like I have. I've been investing for, well, 50 years now. But I want you to remember that there's always going to be risks. They're never going to disappear. So you've got to get the right team around you. And the other lesson, I guess, is don't waste your time worrying, because most of the things you're going to worry about, they're never going to happen. They're just monsters in your mind. So you can minimize your risks by owning the right assets, by getting the right finance structures to see you through the challenging ups and downs of the property cycle, and getting the right people around you. So it's still not too late to take advantage of the opportunities the current property markets are offering. Yes, it would have been better to get in a year or two ago, but why not have a chat with my team at Metropole, because we help you understand what's possible, what's realistic, what's doable, and we help fix problems, we help prevent problems, and we help improve your returns. Fixing problems, we'll actually have a look at what your portfolio is like at the moment, and will it get you to where you want to get to? We'll help prevent problems by getting you the right ownership structures, the right finance in place, the right properties in your portfolio. We'll help you grow your wealth faster and safer than the average investor, because we've got systems that are known, proven, and trusted. Go to metropole.com.au, find out about our strategic property advice, our buyer's agency services, wealth advisory, property management, business advisory, renovations or development. We've got a range of services. I don't know which is going to suit you, but I'd love to be part of your journey. metropole.com.au.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset message, I'd like to explain to you that you should expect failure. And if you do, fear is going to lose its power over you. You see, one of the biggest things holding people back from the pursuit of success, whether it's in property investment, in relationships, in business, in anything, the thing that holds them back is the fact that they fear failure. This fear of failure causes them to second-guess themselves. They second-guess every move they're making. It causes people to overthink everything. It causes people to delay taking action. Overthinking, procrastination, if you think about it, that's really born out of this fear of failure. Interestingly, those who succeed in life do not think they're going to fail. They know it. They know their journey to success will be riddled with failures. It'll be messed up with mistakes. In short, they expect to fail. And when you expect to fail, all of a sudden fear loses all its power over you. When you no longer fear failure, you're going to feel empowered. You're going to feel empowered to take action. Yes, you'll mess up and you're going to make mistakes and you're going to fail often, but you're also going to learn from your mistakes. You will, or you should, learn from your failures. And as you learn, you're going to grow and you're going to improve. This growth is going to help you gain confidence, and this confidence is going to empower you to take even more action. So you've probably heard me say it before. I'm a real success at failure, but I get up one more time, and so should you. Well, I hope you got some benefit from my chat with Simon Kirstenmacher as we talked about what's going to be left behind as a legacy of COVID and what fads hopefully will disappear. Now, if you did get some benefit, if it's going to give you some insights into how to think about investing, about your future, about your business, and you know somebody else who'd get some benefit from it, please help me in my quest to make as many people as financially fluent as possible by sharing details of the Michael Yardney podcast. There's a share button on every podcast app, or just tell them about it, or leave a review, just like the review I read out earlier on. And if I read out your review, I'd be pleased to say thank you by giving you a gift of one of my books. Now, I've also got a gift for you. If you want to learn more about property and you haven't already downloaded the special bonuses I've got for you, just go to podcastbonus.com.au, podcastbonus.com.au, and you'll get a raft of ebooks and reports. I'll be back again real soon, but you can catch me in social media in between these twice weekly podcasts. Just look for Michael Yardney on social media, or join my private Facebook group. Look for the Property Update Facebook group. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropol, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropol to help you?